Chapter 17. Make that bothered tug get the ship's head up again as quick as possible. He blew like mad, waving his arm to port, and presently we could see that the tug's engines had been set going ahead. Her paddles churned the water, but it was as if she had been trying to tow a rock. She couldn't get an inch out of that ship. Again the pilot blew his whistle, and waved his arm to port. We could see the tug's paddles turning faster and faster away, broad on our bow. For a moment tug and ship hung motionless in the crowd of moving shipping, and then the terrific strain that evil, stony-hearted brute would always put on everything, tore the towing chock clean out. The tow rope surged over, snapping the iron stanchions of the head rail one after another, as if they had been sticks of sealing wax. It was only then I noticed that in order to have a better view over our heads, Maggie had stepped upon the port anchor as it lay flat on the forecastle deck. It had been lowered properly into its hardwood beds, but there had been no time to take a turn with it. Anyway, it was quite secure as it was for going into dock, but I could see directly that the tow rope would sweep under the fluke in another second. My heart flew up right into my throat, but not before I had time to yell out, "Jump clear of that anchor!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, but I hadn't time to shriek out her name. I don't suppose she heard me at all. The first touch of the hawser against the fluke threw her down. She was up on her feet again quick as lightning, but she was up on the wrong side. I heard a horrid, scraping sound, and then that anchor, tipping over, rose up like something alive. Its great, rough iron arm caught Maggie round the waist, seemed to clasp her close with a dreadful hug, and flung itself with her over and down in a terrific clang of iron, followed by heavy ringing blows that shook the ship from stem to stern, because the ring stopper held. "How horrible!" I exclaimed. "I used to dream for years afterwards of anchors catching hold of girls," said the man in tweeds, a little wildly. He shuddered. With a most pitiful howl, Charlie was over after her almost on the instant. But, Lord, he didn't see as much as a gleam of her red tam o'shanter in the water. Nothing. Nothing whatever. In a moment there were half a dozen boats around us, and he got pulled into one. I, with the boatswain and the carpenter, let go the other anchor in a hurry, and brought the ship up somehow. The pilot had gone silly. He walked up and down the forecastle head wringing his hands and muttering to himself. "Killing women, now. Killing women, now." Apostrophe, not another word could you get out of him. Dusk fell, then a night black as pitch, and peering upon the river I heard a low, mournful hail, "Ship, ahoy!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, two Graves and watermen came alongside. They had a lantern in their wherry, and looked up the ship's side, holding onto the ladder without a word. I saw in the patch of light a lot of loose, fair hair down there. He shuddered again. After the tide turned, poor Maggie's body had floated clear of one of them big mooring buoys, he explained. I crept aft, feeling half dead, and managed to send a rocket up to let the other searchers know, on the river. And then I slunk away forward like a cur, and spent the night sitting on the heel of the bowsprit so as to be as far as possible out of Charlie's way. "Poor fellow," I murmured. "Yes, poor fellow," he repeated, musingly. "That brute wouldn't let him, not even him, cheat her of her prey. But he made her fast in dock next morning. He did. We hadn't exchanged a word, not a single look for that matter. I didn't want to look at him. When the last rope was fast, he put his hands to his head, and stood gazing down at his feet, as if trying to remember something. The men waited on the main deck for the words that end the voyage. Perhaps that is what he was trying to remember. I spoke for him. That'll do, men." Apostrophe, apostrophe, I never saw a crew leave a ship so quietly. They sneaked over the rail one after another, taking care not to bang their sea chests too heavily. They looked our way, but not one had the stomach to come up and offer to shake hands with the mate as is usual. I followed them all over the empty ship to and fro, here and there, with no living soul about, but the two of us, because the old shipkeeper had locked himself up in the galley both doors. Suddenly poor Charlie mutters, in a crazy voice, I'm done here, apostrophe and strides down the gangway with me at his heels, up the dock, out at the gate, on towards Tower Hill. He used to take rooms with a decent old landlady in America Square, to be near his work. All at once he stops short, turns round, and comes back straight at me. Ned, apostrophe says he, I am going home. I had the good luck to sight a four-wheeler, and got him in just in time. His legs were beginning to give way. In our hall he fell down on a chair, and I'll never forget fathers and mothers amazed, perfectly still faces as they stood over him. They couldn't understand what had happened to him till I blubbered out, Maggie got drowned, yesterday, in the river. Apostrophe apostrophe, mother let out a little cry. Father looks from him to me, and from me to him, as if comparing our faces for, upon my soul, Charlie did not resemble himself at all. Nobody moved, and the poor fellow raises his big brown hand slowly to his throat, and with one single tug rips everything open, collar, shirt, waistcoat, a perfect wreck and ruin of a man. Father and I got him upstairs somehow, and mother pretty nearly killed herself nursing him through a brain fever. The man in tweeds nodded at me significantly. Ah! There was nothing that could be done with that brute. She had a devil in her. Where's your brother? I asked, expecting to hear he was dead. But he was commanding a smart steamer on the China coast, and never came home now. German fetched a heavy sigh, and the handkerchief being now sufficiently dry, put it up tenderly to his red and lamentable nose. She was a ravening beast, the man in tweeds started again. Oh, old Colchester put his foot down and resigned. And would you believe it? Absent Sons wrote to ask whether he wouldn't reconsider his decision. Anything to save the good name of the Apps family. Apostrophe apostrophe old Colchester went to the office then, and said that he would take charge again but, only to sail her out into the North Sea, and scuttle her there. He was nearly off his chump. He used to be darkish iron gray, but his hair went snow white in a fortnight. And Mr. Lucian Apps, they had known each other as young men, pretended not to notice it. Eh? Here's infatuation if you like. Here's pride for you. They jumped at the first man they could get to take her, for fear of the scandal of the Apps family not being able to find a skipper. He was a festive soul, I believe, but he stuck to her grim and hard. Wilmot was his second mate. A harum-scarum fellow, and pretending to a great scorn for all the girls. The fact is he was really timid. But let only one of them do as much as lift her little finger in encouragement, and there was nothing that could hold the beggar. As apprentice, once, he deserted a broad after a petticoat, and would have gone to the dogs then, if his skipper hadn't taken the trouble to find him, and lug him by the ears out of some house of perdition or other. It was said, that one of the firm, had been heard once to express a hope, that this brute of a ship, would get lost soon. I can hardly credit the tale, unless it might have been Mr. Alfred Apps, whom the family didn't think much of. They had him in the office, but he was considered a bad egg altogether, always flying off to race meetings and coming home drunk. You would have thought that a ship so full of deadly tricks would run herself ashore someday out of sheer cussedness. But not she. She was going to last forever. She had a nose to keep off the bottom. German made a grunt of approval. A ship after a pilot's own heart, eh? Jeered the man in tweeds. Well, Wilmot managed it. He was the man for it, but even he, perhaps, couldn't have done the trick without the green-eyed governess, or nurse, or whatever she was to the children of Mr. and Mrs. Pamphilius. Those people were passengers in her from Port Adelaide to the Cape. Well, the ship went out and anchored outside for the day. The skipper, hospitable soul, had a lot of guests from town to a farewell lunch as usual with him. It was 5 in the evening before the last shore boat left the side, and the weather looked ugly and dark in the gulf. There was no reason for him to get underway. However, as he had told everybody he was going that day, he imagined it was proper to do so anyhow. But as he had no mind after all these festivities, to tackle the straits in the dark, with a scant wind, he gave orders to keep the ship under lower topsails, and foresail as close as she would lie, dodging along the land till the morning. Then he sought his virtuous couch. The mate was on deck, having his face washed very clean with hard rain squalls. Wilmot relieved him at midnight. The Yap's family had, as you observed, a house on her poop. Dot, a big, ugly white thing, sticking up, German murmured, sadly, at the fire. That's it. A companion for the cabin stairs, and a sort of chart room combined. The rain drove in gusts on the sleepy Wilmot. The ship was then surging slowly to the southward, close-hauled, with the coast within 3 miles or so to windward. There was nothing to look out for in that part of the gulf, and Wilmot went round to dodge the squalls under the lee of that chart room, whose door on that side was open. The night was black, like a barrel of coal tar, and then he heard a woman's voice whispering to him. That confounded green-eyed girl of the Pamphilius people had put the kids to bed a long time ago, of course, but it seems, couldn't get to sleep herself. She heard 8 bells struck, and the chief mate come below to turn in. She waited a bit, then got into her dressing gown, and stole across the empty saloon, and up the stairs into the chart room. She sat down on the settee near the open door to cool herself, I dare say. I suppose when she whispered to Wilmot it was as if somebody had struck a match in the fellow's brain. I don't know how it was they had got so very thick. I fancy he had met her ashore a few times before. I couldn't make it out, because, when telling the story, Wilmot would break off to swear something awful at every second word. We had met on the quay in Sydney, and he had an apron of sacking up to his chin, a big whip in his hand. A wagon driver. Glad to do anything not to starve. That's what he had come down to. However, there he was, with his head inside the door, on the girl's shoulder as likely as not officer of the watch. The helmsman, on giving his evidence afterwards, said that he shouted several times that the binnacle lamp had gone out. It didn't matter to him, because his orders were to sail her close. I thought it funny, he said, that the ship should keep on falling off in squalls, but I luffed her up every time as close as I was able. It was so dark I couldn't see my hand before my face, and the rain came in bucketfuls on my head. The truth was that at every squall the wind hauled aft a little, till gradually the ship came to be heading straight for the coast, without a single soul in her being aware of it. Wilmot himself confessed that he had not been near the standard compass for an hour. He might well have confessed. The first thing he knew was the man on the lookout shouting blue murder forward there. He tore his neck free, he says, and yelled back at him. What do you say? I think I hear breakers ahead, sir, howled the man, and came rushing aft with the rest of the watch, in the awfulest blinding deluge that ever fell from the sky, Wilmot says. For a second or so he was so scared and bewildered, that he could not remember on which side of the gulf the ship was. He wasn't a good officer, but he was a seaman all the same. He pulled himself together in a second, and the right orders sprang to his lips without thinking. They were to hard up with the helm, and shiver the main and mizzen topsails. It seems that the sails actually fluttered. He couldn't see them, but he heard them rattling and banging above his head. No use. She was too slow in going off, he went on, his dirty face twitching, and the damned carter's whip shaking in his hand. She seemed to stick fast. And then the flutter of the canvas above his head ceased. At this critical moment the wind hauled aft again with a gust, filling the sails, and sending the ship with a great way upon the rocks on her lee bow. She had overreached herself in her last little game. Her time had come, the hour, the man, the black knight, the treacherous gust of wind, the right woman, to put an end to her. The brute deserved nothing better. Strange are the instruments of providence. There's a sort of poetical justice. The man in tweeds looked hard at me. The first let she went over stripped the false keel off her. Rip. The skipper, rushing out of his berth, found a crazy woman in a red flannel dressing gown. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.